Welcome on into the 8 o'clock hour. We're talking Falcons. We're talking Braves. We're talking college football. We're talking fantasy. With the Falcons on the bye, I said, you know what? We're so Falcons all the time, we can actually open it up to a couple of different things. And Falcons obviously getting the priority because of their season and all the expectations and everything that's going on with the team right now, and just a fascinating watch at 2-2 going into the bye. But I said, for the next couple of days, you know, we have a little bit of wiggle room here to explore some other issues going on in the world of sports. And Orin and I were just talking about this in the break, and we will get to some sound from Raheem Morris and Bijan Robinson and Michael Penix Jr. in just a second. Obviously, your number one home, your only home for Falcons content right here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. It's Chris Thomas Turtle with you until 10 o'clock. Orin, we were talking about this in the break. The WNBA is in a very interesting situation right now. They are due for their next CBA.
Staring the CBA down in the face in a league that is getting bigger and bigger very quickly.
And we saw that here in Atlanta with the Dream this offseason, getting Brittany Griner to town with Ryan Howard and Alicia Gray and everybody else that we have on this team that were very, very good. And it's a really, really fun watch. If you haven't been down to the arena, go check it out. But Orin, it's a bit of a rock and a hard place situation for the league, because the women, there's no doubt about it that WNBA players are vastly underpaid. But it's a situation where it's hard for the average casual fan here, which I am and Orin is as well, to really get a full grasp of what the financial, I'll use the word Orin, not, I am not a financial accountant, nor do I play one on the radio, but the financial solvency of the WNBA. Nobody really knows if the league generates a lot of money, how much so. I mean, I'm sure the numbers are out there, but, you know, there's these people that fall back and say, well, the WNBA is funded in part by the NBA and they wouldn't exist without them. And but as Orin correctly pointed out, over the last 5 years, the exponential growth of the league has been really something amazing to watch. So all of that to say, one of the faces of the league, Nafisia Collier of the Lynx, came out in her postseason presser and spoke, Orin, for over 4 minutes straight in a prepared statement to the league, in particular to their upper management and their commissioner, speaking about how the league essentially is not doing right by their players and not giving them the best opportunity to succeed and not giving them the best opportunity to grow the league to its full potential. Kathy Engelbert is the commissioner. She issued a statement back essentially saying, listen, I'm disappointed in Nafisia's messaging, but I'm going to continue to do everything I need to do as commissioner to continue to grow this game. So, Orin, my question is, do you think this CBA will represent a marked improvement in pay, in quality of conditions, in hotels, in plane rides, and everything that this league is not as caught up as other professional sports leagues? Or do you think there really is something to, again, the financial solvency of the league, and how much money do they really have being up for debate? Because I think that's where the ultimate question lies.
The WNBA is such an interesting league in the sense that it has the world's best players. It's the world's best competition. You could argue the most eyes are on that league. But in terms of where it lies in the financial realm of basketball players getting paid, ladies can go overseas and make more money. Unrivaled now is a league that exists where you're not only getting paid, but you have equity in the league. So as it grows, your pockets get bigger as well.
Yep.
So there are so many more as the WNBA has grown, there have been more avenues now outside of the WNBA for professional women basketball players to go get paid elsewhere. And I think the problem is everybody that's in the WNBA wants to see the WNBA become the world's biggest women's basketball league. they want to be fully invested and committed into seeing this league become whatever the best potential for it. And it's not happening right now. So the next CBA is going to be interesting because, like you said, one, what's the actual worth of this league? It's hard to put in some ways a dollar value, but we saw TV numbers go up this year.
Well, here's the thing, Oren, to your point, I don't think it's a matter of if they deserve it, because I think we all know that they do. It's a matter of if the league can afford to do it. I think that's really what it comes down to. And the answer to that, I don't know. I have no idea. I know the average valuations for franchises are going way up. But again, what is the actual red versus black in terms of what these teams are taking home, their expenses, ticket sales, revenue, merch sales? Like, where does all of that stand right now in terms of a professional league? Like, is it, even though the number is obviously much smaller, is it commiserate to their NBA partners? Meaning, does the NBA dish out the same percentage of money to its players based on its revenue as the WNBA? That I don't know the answer to either. Like, what does the average WNBA player get in terms of what their team makes versus an NBA player? Seems like it's pretty small.
And I think, too, a lot of the players in the WNBA now are recognizing that so many more of their games that used to not be televised or seen by all those eyes are televised now. They're on networks all over the place. So it's tough if you're a WNBA player to sit back and go, all right, you're telling me there is no money, but we're seeing all this growth in merchandising, all this growth in TV exposure. If there's all of this growth that's occurring within the game itself, then where are the financials that are also helping this game grow? Where's all that money going? So where, if there is money being kind of, if there is money that to be spent, where is that money and where is it going?
You know what's astounding? I mean, this is really astounding. I just looked at Nafisia Collier as an example. Her salary breakdown, Oren.
It's ridiculous.
She made.
She's an NBA. She's an MVP.
She signed a 3-year, $500,000 contract as a league MVP. Wow. I mean, that just goes to show you exactly where. As a rookie, she made $70,000.
I mean, Angel Reese is very open about how everything that she does off the court is what gives her the majority of her financial stability. Everything that comes from her not playing basketball.
Yeah, her podcast, her fashion, her
The shoe
YouTube,
line, yeah. Yeah.
All that other stuff. So this is very interesting. Again, if you missed it, why are we talking about this? Because one of the game's biggest stars, Nafisia Collier, came out for her end-of-the-year presser and with a 4-minute-long written statement just absolutely tore into the WNBA commissioner's office. It's one of the crazier statements of power you'll see an athlete put on display, just uninterrupted, 4.5 minutes of just bashing the WNBA. It's crazy. It's out there on Twitter. Just search Nafisia Collier. All right, with a couple of minutes left here, let's hear from Raheem Morris. He gave an update on Storm Norton, AJ Terrell, and Darnell Mooney.
I don't have a lot of information on those guys yet. I got a medical meeting coming up here in a little bit. I probably have more after that. Be way more informative next week when we get back. I have to go check on Storm, check on all those guys, obviously on our IR. Obviously, you potentially could open up a couple of those windows coming up here shortly, you know, after the 4 weeks are up, and then that's up, and then you open those things up. You still got those weeks that you can have kind of as buffers. So we'll get a feel where they're all at after coming to these medical meetings. I don't have a lot of information on it. Hoping that we can get AJ back, you know, after this bye, another week of rest for him and get a chance to get him out there. That's probably the one I do have a little bit more information on than the other guy. Don't know anything about Mooney other than, you know, we'll have to see from this week. Obviously, he left yesterday with the hamstring. So we'll see. I don't know how bad it was, but I don't think it's something too bad. But we'll get a check. I'll get a feel for it later.
All right. Sounds like AJ Terrell is the closest to coming back. Raheem also talking about when it came down to the bye week last year, what did they try to do and what are they going to try to do now?
Yeah, you know, we just kind of went back and looked at the study of it all and how to get open and how to utilize, you know, some of the guys that we did have. You know, like Caden was a big part of that and how we wanted to utilize him, how we wanted to set him up. You know, obviously AK at the time, he was a part of that as well and getting those guys going and trying to find ways and trying to find different things that we can get going that way. You know, all of those guys up front being in different positions and trying to get those guys aligned to different things so we can dictate terms a little bit better. So that was a part of it on defense.
Yeah, and we're going to see, you know, obviously they're in a different position now and coming off of a great win. So maybe, you know, you don't need to scrutinize every micro, you know, situation, but Raheem Morris and his staff will certainly be all over it. He talked about specifically on defense what they're going to look at.
For us, it's like finishing. You know, we like, you want to go find ways to finish some of those sacks. I think we had 15 pressures yesterday, had 2 sacks. You know, and we had the big 6-sack game, I believe, on in Minnesota. You want to find ways to capitalize more of those opportunities, because if you do those things, you know, you can be really effective, you know, on that way. When you're talking about on defense, and then, you know, obviously on.
And leading right into the next cut, Oren, let's just play it. He was talking about what they need to do on offense.
Offense, it'd be about just continuing to let our identity come out. I think our identity came out in a major way yesterday when it came to running the football and then being able to get some of those throws off and play action pass. You know, he was 76% passing and doing some of those things, some really good things. We got the long ball going, so to speak, yesterday. I think that was another part of it. So just really increasing those things and doing some of those different things that way.
And last but not least, an area I think we all can admit needs probably the most attention during this time, that's the special teams, Coach.
You know, special teams, it's like, let's keep growing, let's keep getting better, right? Our field goal team did their job yesterday. That was awesome. And then also, our coverage units have really been outstanding other than outside of that one from yesterday. They've really been outstanding when it came to coverage. And now how do we get some of our return game going? You know, we got a little bit going yesterday with the kickoff return. And then hopefully Agnew coming back yesterday will spark some of the punt return things for us and we can get some of those stops. So you always want to keep improving and keep going. But really, you just build off your natural things that you have and what your identity looks like and making sure it's coming out on tape.
I'm excited to see it. I think they have a shot to take down Buffalo, but it's a lot of it's going to depend on what they do between now and then. All right, we haven't talked any college ball. Let's react to Georgia, Georgia Tech, and the rest of the college football world. Our buddy Ian Valentino, A to Z Sports, is going to stop by next to break down everything. Are the Dogs done? I don't think so, but maybe. Oh, boy. They certainly went down in the standings. We'll talk about all that and more next. Sports Radio 92.9 The Game is your home of live college football coverage in Atlanta. This Saturday at 8 a.m., we get the day started with college football game time brought to you by Window Nation. Visit windownation.com and Alumni Hall. Shop UGA, Bama, Tennessee, and more. It's where the fans shop. John Fricke, Chris Goforth, Abe Gordon, and Garrett Chapman will get you set for the stage of all the big matchups. Then at 11:30 a.m., it's a doubleheader. We have Clemson at North Carolina, followed by Texas at Florida. That's all this Saturday on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. It is Chris Thomas tonight. Turtle with you until 10 o'clock. Let's have a college football conversation, shall we, on the WadeFord.com hotline with our good buddy Ian Valentino of A to Z Sports. Ian, let's start here in Atlanta and Athens. What level, if any, of concern do you have about UGA after their loss to Bama?
You know, it's an unexpected loss, but I don't think it's, you know, a level 10 type of worry. I think this is, it's a concern, but you're probably afforded 2 losses in the SEC this year before you really have to, you know, it's kind of like do or die at that point. Like, I don't know that you can get in with 3 losses. Maybe we'll see how it shakes out the rest of the season. But, you know, I think Oklahoma, Texas, you know, teams like that, even LSU, we saw them lose. I think each of these teams has some sort of flaw. And I think Georgia was part of that too. Like, it's a good team, but I think we knew that it wasn't going to be a perfect team. So it's disappointing to lose because it's a rivalry, and especially with Kirby Smart struggles, I think, against Alabama. That might be a bigger picture, slight concern. But at the same time, too, this is a team that can recover. You're looking at a quarterback who can get better, a defense that is probably capable of being even sharper than what we saw. So it's a tough rivalry loss, but that's exactly what it could only be. It could only be a rivalry loss and not a sign of bigger things that they need to be concerned about.
So what do you make of Alabama now between the way they started and the way they're playing now? This team is a bit of a head scratcher.
Yeah, I think while it's easy to kind of say for Georgia, hey, that doesn't have to be a referendum of their entire team and season, Alabama just might have reinvented themselves a little bit. The passing game has been a lot better. Ty Simpson looks really good, making great decisions. Obviously, the numbers kind of speak for themselves, but he does look more comfortable. He looks like he's fitting in. Obviously, getting Ryan Williams back is a huge part of that. They have a little bit more playmaking. The run game is a big concern. Like, they just cannot run the ball well. So I'm still a little bit worried about that when it matters most. It reminds me of that Washington team that Kalen DeBauer reached the national championship with. It's kind of funny how he's almost modeled it exactly like that team. But this is a good team, and credit to them. I didn't really see that gear for them entering the season, and they very quickly found it and put things together and abandoned what doesn't work and really embrace what does work for them. And so they're on pace for probably, you know, to be right in the mix of the college football playoff. And I just don't think – personally, I just didn't have that in my cards.
Speaking of that, what do you make of what Ole Miss has done?
Well, that's going to be probably the most fascinating thing to watch for the next couple of weeks. I mean, to do what they're doing to beat LSU, which, yeah, they've got their own offensive issues, injury issues, certainly. But, you know, to do this with a backup quarterback to beat a team that looked like maybe the second, third best team in the country, to do it the way that they did it, too. I mean, it wasn't just, hey, we're going to slow down your offense. No, they handled them like that. That wasn't as close to the final score. So Lane Kiffin, all of a sudden, he replaces half of his best defensive players from last year, and they might be the most well-rounded team in the SEC. So it's a loaded conference this year, and I don't think in a way that, you know, some expected, most expected. Like, we thought Texas was going to be the powerhouse. Well, that turns out to be maybe they're the third or fourth best team in the conference. So you're seeing really young players get into big roles early and adjust within the first couple of the games of the season and play really well. And so that's it's got us kind of looking at these standings upside down from where they thought they'd be.
Speaking of that, Vandy, can they actually, I mean, if you look at their schedule, it is absolutely brutal, but can they compete against the big dogs?
Yeah, I think on a game-by-game basis, sure. Like, they're going to have a chance this week. As much as I'm talking about Alabama, I don't think Alabama is some, like, you know, guarantee to win this week. And they're going to have to fight for this. Vandy is very well-rounded. Really good defense, one of the better defenses in the country. They play great as a unit. Obviously, as long as they have Diego Pavia on offense, their passing game is going to be explosive. They're going to be a threat to run the ball. They're not in a tremendously good running game, but that doesn't mean that they can't make it happen a little bit better when they need to than Alabama does. So, yeah, I don't think if you look at, like, the whole season, I think it's just too much, right? It's like Florida. Florida's schedule from the start was just too daunting. They never had a chance. Vandy, they can at least maybe split those big games, right? If you've got 5-6 top-ranked opponents on your schedule, can they win three of them and get a really good bowl game? Yeah, I think that is in their cards. It's just a matter of which games do they actually pull the wins out of, and which ones do they fall short. And that just comes down to the margin of error.
Least surprising thing from the weekend, Penn State loses another big game.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know what James Franklin has to do. Maybe he needs to recuse himself as a head coach in these big games, but they've just got an identity issue in these games, and it's to the point where I don't know how you get over the hump. He's continued to struggle regardless of the roster, completely different roster, completely different coaching staff. There's just something about these games he's not prepping his team for in the right manner, building up to them. So whatever he's been doing, I think he might need to just completely switch it and maybe lean the other direction. If he's selling this as a big game to his guys, maybe underscore the game a little bit. If he's underscoring the game a little bit, maybe make this the biggest deal in the history of sports. I'm not really sure, but it's confounding. That team is too talented to continue to lose these games. And the program in general has been too talented over the years to lose every single time in almost the same type of manner. It's really, kind of talked about it with some of the SEC teams. It's like you expected Penn State to be the best team in the country, and there's not been a single moment where they've looked it this year.
Do you believe they made a mistake in bringing back Drew Aller?
Well, Bo Prabula's done pretty decently. I don't want to say they made the mistake, but I do think that they probably needed to recognize that their staff and situation is not the right one to get the most out of him. They brought in three new receivers in the transfer portal. They obviously have the running back talent that they brought back. But everything's in place there for that team to be really good, for that offense to be great. Something that is there with Aller, if he has it in him to get better, clearly the staff is not the staff to get it out of him, or he just can't get better. That's the alternative. He might just need very high-level NFL-level coaching, maybe like Sean McVay, someone like that. But that's very specific, and you can't really do much about that if you're Penn State. So I think you welcome him back because you wanted to get that chance. And you probably don't bring everyone back from last year if Aller leaves too. So that's probably a package deal. But yeah, I think, you know, he caps your ceiling, and Bo Prabula might not have. So that's a tough choice. In retrospect, I don't think you could ever make that decision and justify it. But at the same time, it'll make you wonder, you know, could they have had a higher ceiling with a guy that maybe was a little bit less proven but has better physical traits?
Talking all things college ball with our buddy Ian Valentino, A to Z Sports. Check him out there. It is Chris Thomas tonight with you until 10 o'clock. How does Kurt Cignetti do it at Indiana? I mean, the guy is as grating as anything, but he gets the results, Ian.
Yeah, there's something there. There's, you know, talking about it with Franklin, where there's just that spark. There's that ability to understand big games, the ability to get your guys up, get them, you know, peak performance at the right time. Franklin struggled with that, but then someone like Cignetti, they have it. And he's got a little bit more of a background in team building, where as you look at someone like Kalen DeBauer, he generally takes over rosters and can do pretty well. He hasn't really proven that he can build a team, whereas Cignetti, his ability to work the portal, get guys to buy in, maximize them, and that's pretty special. And whether he can do that to the level of winning a championship, I think is a different question. He's very clearly good enough and able to connect with kids in a way that most other coaches can't. And to be able to do this in his first couple of years there in a school that just hasn't had that success in a long time, and especially not consistently, it's really remarkable. And I'm fascinated to see how it plays out there, like whether he stays there long term or if he can get that and that Indiana group to a championship level and not just like a third or fourth in the Big Ten level.
Which Texas team are you more buying, A&M or Tech?
I think A&M, and I think the big part there is they, you know, you hate to fall back on recruiting and things like that, but a lot of the guys that they get, a lot of the guys that they put in the NFL are athletes that are capable of being amazing. They just haven't had the coaching. Maybe it's the personalities that they've recruited in the past that weren't right to be able to maximize their abilities in college. Tech just doesn't quite have the history and the years of deep recruiting success. And I know the transfer portal has been great to them. They've done an amazing job. But I do think that there's an overall depth and talent difference there. Now, whether that shows up on Saturdays is a different thing consistently. But until we kind of see Tech take on one of those top tier teams, and it's going to be a little while before we see them really play anyone that really proves themselves, if at all, and before the playoff, I think A&M gets the nod just because I know that they can compete and beat teams like Notre Dame and compete with and beat teams at the top of the SEC, despite their issues in the past, kind of like Penn State. They're very much like Penn State of the South. So they have to prove themselves in those games, but beating Notre Dame was a big part of that.
Here locally, Georgia Tech gets a scare, but they pull it out. Last second victory versus Wake. Now they get a bye. Did that scare you at all, or is that just part of a college football season where you just get tested sometimes?
Yeah, you're going to get tested at some point. I mean, even the best teams like Ohio State, Oregon, those teams are going to get tested at some point. It's going to be a team that you don't expect. It's just how it works. You can't always be ready for teams, or you can, at least maybe tactically, and then you get out there and then you realize you're a bunch of 17, 18, 19-year-olds, and some of these things just go strange and you don't really know. But they pulled it out, and I think that's one thing to bank on. Were there things to be concerned about? Sure, like you didn't play sharp. You can't have that continue too often. But the positive is that things didn't go well and you still recovered and you faced that adversity. And I do think, you know, you talk to coaching staffs, any coaching staff you've ever talked to, it's like, yeah, we'd love to win every game 50-0, but if we don't, we can actually go back to the drawing board now and connect with guys a little bit easier to give them something to work on and actually try to improve on. And I think they're going to be able to take that tactic and hopefully kind of shore up some of those mistakes and just a little bit of sloppy play that we saw.
Before I let you go, I'm looking down at the latest top 25. BYU, they're sitting there at 4-0. We know that their schedule isn't monstrous by any stretch. Are they kind of sitting around there as a sleeper?
Yeah, I think so. They've had a great run. Again, you go back to coaching, another really well-coached team, and consistently getting the most out of guys. They run their system. They like how they do things, but they kind of keep it like an engine, and it doesn't really matter who they plugged in there. And so you like to see that, but they have a lot of talent. They do a good job of coming up to the big games. Yeah, I think this is definitely one of those teams that they're able to put a scare into anybody. Like, they have the ability to create big plays pretty easily. They have the defensive talent, I think, to at least be disruptive against most of the teams, maybe not the top two or three, four teams, but to get out of their conference and to sneak into the playoff at the back end and be a bit of a nightmare matchup, depending on who they play. Yeah, I think so. Like, that's not one of those teams. I think I'd rather play last year's like Tennessee squad in the playoff than this year's BYU team. And some of that just comes down to toughness, knowing who you are and consistently playing to that level. That's a gritty team that can create explosive plays, and that's never fun.
Ian, appreciate the time as always. We'll chat soon.
Thanks so much.
All right, that is Ian Valentino there. Check him out at A2Z Sports College Football. All right, when we get back, it's our weekly producer six-pack time with Big O. Four sports questions of any kind and two lifestyle questions. I know what his last question is going to be, and I need y'all's help on this one. Got a very interesting situation coming up this weekend. We'll talk about all that and more next on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Chris Thomas tonight. So, something just happened to me that I know a lot of y'all out there can relate to. And this never really happens to me. I've been blessed and highly favored that my body has held up pretty well over my 33 years on this planet. Not a lot of catastrophic injuries, as they say, to report. I tore my ankle up once. I tore my knee up once. Orin, the worst injury I ever had in my life was, I was an idiot. I was like 15.
Uh-oh.
I jumped on a treadmill, and I put it as high as it can go.
Oh, no.
I don't know why I did that. I was
because you were 15?
I was just dumb. And I fell on the treadmill with my knees, and it burned off all seven layers of skin
gone
in my knees. And I had to spend an entire summer on crutches.
Because you burned your knees
because
off.
Because my knees had to regenerate, essentially. But other than that, and that was self-inflicted, I've been pretty sturdy. It is Chris Thomas tonight, Turtle, with you till 10. We'll get to a producer six-pack here in just a second. Joe Patrick coming up next hour with all things Falcons as well. When I just went to go get a fresh water from my backpack during the break, when I took my first step down out of the chair, I was like, ow, what in the world was that? And then as I kept walking, my ankle just completely tightened up on me. Out of nowhere, I was like, whoa, what is this?
Uh-oh.
And again, I'm lucky. You know, it's one of those things you don't realize it till something happens. And, like, there were no warning signs. I walked here as usual today, had a normal morning. And, I mean, it feels pretty fine now, but, like, it's just one of those things, like, just a random pain that comes out of nowhere. And the cliche is, Orin, well, as you get older, your body just starts to hurt.
And just things start to fall apart.
Do you have any ailments that continuously bother you?
Oh, boy. So I have had two major surgeries on my legs. I had one, a full ACL replacement. I have a cadaver ACL in my left. Make sure that's the right. Yeah, my left knee is a
cadaver. How long was the recovery on that?
Oh, so I kind of zoomed through it. And not to say that, like, I'm blessed or anything or special, but
you're Adrian Peterson?
I was off crutches on it very quickly. When I was just kind of sitting around at home and I wasn't doing anything, like, I would do flexibility exercises on it. I tried to go and get in pools and whirlpools and work it out as much as I could just to keep it. I kept it moving for as long as I possibly could. So, like, within a couple months, I had almost full range of mobility and, like, where I could bend it and whatnot. So that was good with that one. The other one was kind of freaky. I broke my leg, and they had to put a rod and eight screws in, and
so
one of the screws
like
was going to come out.
Bionic man.
Well, this is what happened. They took the eighth screw out, and the rod and seven screws are supposed to stay in for the rest of my life. Decided that I would go and start pounding around on it, and I turned it, and an incision that was, I thought, closed on my leg wasn't all the way closed.
Oh, no.
So I got the most gnarly staph infection, and I say the most gnarly. This happened in February. I had to have what's called an IND, incision and drain, a couple weeks later. And then in August of that year, there was a sinus cavity that was draining in my leg. So they had to go in and remove, I kid you not, like 2 inches of bone. They had to go and remove it. And I was on intensive antibiotics for 3 days.
Oh, man.
The doctor was like, yeah, chances are, you know, at your age, I was in my early 20s. Like, yeah, at your age, you're probably not going to grow that bone back. It's just going to be a gap there. Like, is it going to be weird? It's like, no, you should be okay. 2 months later, I not only regrew the bone, but it reset itself. The doctor was like, this doesn't really happen in people your age at all. So this is sort of a medical marvel you are right now. Like, I'm actually really, really impressed right now that not only it grew back, but it sort of reset itself back in. So yeah, the bone regrew and set back in. So,
well, it needed to support your 6'5" frame.
But to answer your question, I have ankle pains and lower leg pains on my right side. And then I have left knee pains. In some ways, when weather starts to get bad, I can get a little bit arthritic. I can become a little human weather bane. I have like neck pain, just residual neck pain from playing football growing up. Like, that's just sort of there. It's never really like been like a painful thing. But and then every once in a while, I'll get sciatica. It's just big people stuff, I guess.
I remember
I'll get sciatica.
When Carl had that like a year ago.
Sciatica is no joke,
he
man.
He was, you talk about bent out of shape. I mean, he was
there
a
is
wreck for a few days.
No position that is comfortable for you to sit or lie down.
Oh,
in.
That sounds
none
awesome.
Whatsoever. And it radiates, man. Like, you make one wrong move and it's from your lower back all the way up and then from your like thigh all the way down. It just, oh my gosh, it's so uncomfortable.
Well, if it's anything like that pain where, you know, if you've ever thrown your back out or like moved something too heavy with your lower back where you just feel it like an electric shock almost going through your back. Yeah, that's awful. Well, we'll see if the producer six pack is any more cheery.
It is funny though, because I'm joking. Like, yeah, I have a donated body part inside of me. Like, what? Yeah, I have a cadaver ACL. So there you go.
Well, it's being put to good use because you need it.
I need it. Yeah, my last one was completely shredded. So yeah, when I tore my knee up, I tore ACL, MCL, PCL. I didn't quite do as badly as Tyreek Hill did.
So your leg wasn't bent the other way?
But it did bend. Oof. Oh, I landed on the inside part of it and came straight down on it.
Ugh.
Like, it was bad. I chipped the top of my kneecap.
Did
so
your
was
full
like,
body weight come
yeah,
down?
Full oh, bone. Yeah. I popped a blood vessel, and my leg looked like a steak. It was just was, oh. Yeah, it was bad. It looked like it was messed up just off the jump. All right.
And he never played basketball ever again.
Just stayed. I'm level now. Just on level surfaces. That's where
they talk
I am.
About feet to the ground.
That's
Orin
that's
is the
me.
Living embodiment.
Me.
Of
if
that.
My feet aren't touching ground, then something's the matter.
Well, lucky for you, you can see above almost anyone that's in front of you. So
there you go.
You're good.
We're going to look to the future tonight, Chris. Look to the future, both the immediate future and the more immediate future, sir.
Okay.
So let's start here in college football, sir. UGA, this is an incredible stat, by the way. Cole Kublik posted this stat after the loss of Saturday night. Saturday was the first game in the last 72 games that UGA, at some point in the ball game, did not have a lead. It's the first time in 72 games where UGA was not leading at
so
some point during the game.
Pillar to post against
they
Alabama.
Trailed from okay. start to finish.
Wow.
An incredible wow. stat. 72 games they've gone not trailing in a ball game. Or excuse me, being up in a ball game. UGA is in the playoffs, sir, at the end of this season.
I'm worried. I don't like their schedule now. Here's the thing. Does two losses definitely get you in? I think that's the question. Because I don't think they're going to go through 11-1. I think they're going to have at least.
So they got in with two losses last year, but it was two losses and an SEC championship.
Title.
Yeah, and then Texas, on the other hand, was, what, two losses and runner-up in the SEC.
If I gave you Alabama or the field to be in the SEC championship game to meet Georgia, what would you take?
The field.
You think Ole Miss is?
Ole Miss is playing really well right now.
Missouri's 5-0.
I still don't know what Texas is just yet.
Yeah,
I think Texas can get it back at some point.
It didn't feel like another Georgia-Bama year at the beginning.
It didn't.
Kind of starting to feel that way again.
Possibly. We could see those two at the end of the season again, maybe. And hopefully Kirby is not 1-8. At the end of that ball game?
Well, if Georgia gets three losses, I don't think it's happening. But if they get two, I think there's a good chance.
David Pollack, his C-Ball, Get Ball podcast, he thinks that Georgia is closer to an 8-4 team than they are a 10-2 team. That would be losses to more than likely Ole Miss, Texas, and Georgia Tech remaining on their schedule.
Hot take Pollack, is that a thing now? He's usually not a hot take guy, so he must really believe it.
Yeah.
Nah, they're still good enough. That's a lot, man. Come on, Pollack, support the red and
he supports
black.
He supports the red and black. He does that. Yes.
8-4.
8-4.
Would you, if they go 8-4, would you hear rumblings about Kirby?
No,
not yet.
No. You got two titles in a row. I mean. But Dabo hasn't won a title in how long? And
2019.
The year before LSU. So that'd be 2019 on the 2020 season. It would take a whole lot. Now, you might start calling into question what UGA is doing in the transfer portal and with NIL money.
And coordinators for sure.
And assistant coaches, yeah. Like, all that stuff will get called into question before, well before you say anything negative about Kirby Smart's
job. You know what's funny? I would actually be interested to see how Kirby would respond to an 8-4 season. Like, would he come back and just be, like, he just transforms his entire life? Because you know how, obsessed is not the right word. Like, he would just come back, like, skinny and like fit and like on a vegetarian diet, and like his wife would be concerned about him because he spent 6 months straight locked in his office.
In Kirby Smart's tenure, they have had 2 8-win seasons. His first year at Georgia, they were 8-5, and then the COVID shortened year, they were 8-2. That one isn't really 8-2 is still sort of weird on that one, but his first season.
Yeah, but the standard's different now.
Yeah. Every other year, though, has been a double-digit win year. Excuse me. Every other year has been at least 11 wins.
Yeah. So if he went 8-4 now, again, I think he'd have to have some sort of personal revelation in the offseason and redefine his approach as a coach. Not because he has to. He wouldn't have to. But because I think it would eat at him so badly. Like, these guys, like, literally live and die with it. So I think if he went, I would be fascinated to see his approach in the offseason and how he would come back from that. I don't think it's going to happen, though.
Close. All right. All right. Number two. There was a very curious signing for the Braves at the end of this season.
Oh, boy.
Don't know if a lot of people saw this.
It did go under the radar.
It did go under the radar, and because the minor league season was over with, this guy didn't go to the minors and play with the minor league affiliates. Alek Manoah, former, if you want to call him an ace in Toronto, had maybe one and a half good seasons up there. got hurt, then lost it. Got signed to a big deal before he lost it. Last couple of years have not been great. Was designated for assignment after pitching with the minor league team this year in Toronto, but was picked up by Alex Anthopoulos and the Braves before the season's end.
You don't say.
This is a guy who's got starter's experience. He's got possibly still a very live arm. He's young. So he's one of those type of prospects, I guess you could say, one of those type of players that the Braves bring in and they attempt to fix. Is Alek Manoah in the Braves starting rotation next year?
I hope not. Because if that's the plan, come on, man. Come on, Alek Manoah, we looked it up. He had one good season. One. And it was 3 going on 4 years ago. The dude does not take care of himself. Listen, I'm no, you know, stones from a glass house. But, you know, he's 6'6". He's almost 300 pounds, you know. His body's breaking down on him. That's not the answer. Alek Manoah. Oh, God, no. I mean, could he be a spot starter at, you know, game 87 of the season when you need a blow? Okay. But I'm not looking at Alek Manoah as the future. The only argument you can make is that he's still young. He's not even 27 yet. So there's a chance he could have a resurgence. But, Oren, isn't this the most Braves thing ever? It's just, ugh.
You go and you get a guy who you think you can fix this person.
Ugh.
Just, hey, Braves fans, do not be. And, hey, if it works out next year for the Braves.
No, great, of course.
Then, Alex, hey, hats off to you, but it just seems like one of those moves that has been typical of Braves front office management the last few years.
I just don't want that to be the plan. That's what I am worried about. Like, that's not the plan, right? Like, he's just a fun potential rebuild project and nothing more, right?
Right.
All right, we'll speed through the next couple here.
All righty. Hawks are at 50 wins at next season's end.
Yes, I'm a big believer in this Hawks squad. I think they're going to be a top 5 seed in the East this year. Love the Hawks.
Blank is holding the trophy at the end of the World Series.
I'm going to go with the Dodgers. You got to be the man, you got to beat the man.
Fair enough. Weekend plan, sir. We'll wrap with this. We'll wrap with weekend
okay.
plans.
Okay. Here's, because I need a second.
Here's a story with this, yes.
I need a second here. For the first time in as long as I can remember, I have a full, we'll call it a voluptuous, 3-day weekend.
No Sunday things.
No Friday things either. Friday, we got the high school scoreboard show. Saturday, we're airing 2 college football games, so my Saturday show is on pause for a week. And then Sunday, the Falcons are off. Oren, I got 3 whole days. Here's the kicker. My girl is out of town. She's going to visit a friend in Chicago this weekend. So I have a full 3-day weekend, solo dolo. I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't remember the last time I've had this much time by myself. I got to pick out movies. I got to go places. I got to do some stuff, man. I can't just be sitting at home for 3 days straight. Twitter, what should I do? 404-726-0929 at C Thomas Radio. What should I do this weekend? I got a little dilemma on my hands. I got Friday, Saturday, Sunday off. And my girl's not in town, so I can literally do whatever I want. I can go see any movie I want. I can go to whatever stores I want. I can eat whatever I want. Everything and anything is on the table. What should I do? Right? It's interesting, Oren. What should I do?
The city is your oyster, buddy.
It really is. It's been so long.
This is the time, the ones that suck, too, because, and not in a bad, but you had. You want to go out and do everything or anything that you possibly can, and then it just becomes like, I think I just want to sit around the house and do absolutely nothing.
Yeah, like it's just like, man, how many hours of video games am I going to play?
Oh, my gosh.
All right, good stuff there from when we get back, we'll go over the biggest headlines from college ball from the weekend, who are the contenders and the pretenders. You'll hear from Kirby Smart as well. We got a big 9 o'clock hour coming your way.